I'm Leonard Lope. Welcome to my show. Vanity Fair columnist Christopher Hitchens is a strong supporter of the war in Iraq, and former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter opposes it. They join me now to air their disagreements and to determine whether there's any common ground between them. Christopher Hitchens' latest book is Thomas Jefferson, Author of America. It's published by Imminent Lives. Scott Ritter's new book is Iraq Confidential. It is published by Nation Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome them both back to my show today. Hi.
Good morning. Good morning.
You both seem to have switched sides. Do the traditional labels liberal, conservative, dove, hawk apply when it comes to the two of you? Christopher, do you still identify yourself as a liberal?
I've never identified myself as a liberal, but I spent a long time on the political left, Marxist left. And though I don't really find myself at home in that world anymore, it must mean something to me because I always find it nauseating to see secularists and humanists and leftists making excuses for Islamic fascism and for gangsterism of the kind that is politely described as insurgent.
So is this what? So is Iraq what moved you out of the left, or had you been moving there anyway?
My initial commitment is kind of you to ask. I mean, it goes back a long way, and it begins in an elementary manner. It was a matter of solidarity with those Iraqis and Kurds who wanted to move their country into the post-Saddam era. That seemed to me an elementary piece of internationalism. As it happens, a lot of those people, particularly among the Kurdish leadership, have political backgrounds similar to mine, Marxist left types and secularists, and I'm on their side still against the barbaric right-wing and confessional elements in their country. So for me, that's fairly seamless.
Do you find it ironic that Scott's book is published by The Nation, a magazine you worked for many years?
I don't really see where the irony would be there.
Well, you're no longer there, and here is Scott. Scott, how would you describe your political philosophy?
Well, I'm a conservative American. I'm a registered Republican, but I call myself an American first and foremost, somebody who is a strict adherent to the Constitution of the United States of America. In addition to being a former UN weapons inspector, I spent 12 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Marine Corps. I've gone to war for my country, and I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, an oath that I take seriously to this day. And I don't find any deviation whatsoever in my thinking across the board. I'm not a pacifist. I'm not somebody who has rejected war. In fact, I am a trained warrior, one who has been to war and understands why my nation goes to war. And for that reason, I am vehemently opposed to the war we are currently waging in Iraq.
Have you been opposed to it from the start?
Absolutely.
Did a war with Iraq seem inevitable based on what you saw as a UN weapons inspector?
War with Iraq was inevitable given what I saw of U.S. policy towards Iraq. One has to understand that this is not a war that is unilaterally waged by George W. Bush and his administration. The policies of the United States towards Iraq regarding regime change in particular have transcended three consecutive presidential administrations. And when one takes a look at, you know, the sanctions-based, the sanctions-based containment of Iraq and the policy of regime change, understand that for 8 years of the Clinton administration, these policies were sustained and perfected, and indeed these policies were transferred over to the Bush administration. So this is an American policy, not just a Bush policy.
It's been pointed out that a previous book of yours, Endgame, suggested that Saddam really was a big threat to national security and should be taken out. Was that your feeling at the time?
Well, first of all, instead of suggesting what my book says, let's talk about what my book says. Endgame clearly states that there was a Security Council resolution passed under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter that provided a mandate for the disarmament of Iraq and found that Iraq, in possessing weapons of mass destruction as defined by this mandate, represented a clear and present risk to international peace and security. And I pointed out, as a weapons inspector, not just a weapons inspector, perhaps one of the more aggressive and important weapons inspectors involved in that process, that we had not certified Iraq as being free of weapons of mass destruction. Therefore, the Security Council's findings regarding Iraq still stood, and that we cannot say that Iraq does not pose a threat. But we also must reflect on the nature of that threat as Americans when we talk about dealing with that threat. And again, there's a difference between Security Council resolutions and ordering American military forces into combat. American military forces can only be ordered into combat if the Congress of the United States finds that a situation exists that threatens the Constitution, the national security interests of the United States of America. And I pointed out that American policy vis-a-vis Iraq during the Clinton administration, because the first book was a book about the Clinton foreign policy, that the Clinton administration, A, did not ever give Iraq a fair chance to disarm. In fact, the Clinton administration's policies were to maintain economic sanctions against Iraq regardless of its disarmament obligation, that the Clinton administration was not acting as a fair supporter of Security Council mandate, that the Clinton administration was engaged in a unilateral policy of regime change that was not sustained by international law, nor was it sustained by American law until 1998, and that this created what I call unsustainable policy, meaning that it has nowhere to go. It cannot succeed. It has no end game, and it's a policy that I opposed.
My guests are Scott Ritter, whose latest book is Iraq Confidential. Also, Christopher Hitchens, whose latest book is Thomas Jefferson, Author of America. We're speaking to them by phone because of the transit strike, and we will be giving you an update from one of our reporters later in the show. In fact, right after we go to a break in a few minutes. Christopher, you were opposed to the first war in Iraq, the so-called Gulf War. What led you to be such an avid supporter of this one?
Well, when I look back on it, my opposition to the war was that a very strong, visceral dislike of the first President Bush and a very strong suspicion of him as a survivor and unindicted co-conspirator of the Iran-Contra affair. I admit that there was some sheer political bile involved. I also thought it was a war, if you like, for the status quo, merely for the restoration of the previous royal family in Kuwait. It wasn't a regime change war, even though regime change rhetoric, comparing, for example, Saddam Hussein to the Third Reich, was employed in it. There was something cynical about the way it was designed, if you like, because I remember, as probably you do, the way that April Glaspie, the American ambassador in Iraq, on the instructions of James Baker, had told Saddam Hussein in advance that an attack on Kuwait would not be a casus belli. Mm-hmm. And I was depressed by the cynical way that it ended, with the scattering and near massacre again of the Kurdish people. I was by that stage in northern Iraq. And I decided that, in order to be honest with myself, I should have said, this took me a while to evolve, I'm condensing it a bit, but I should have said that on condition of the removal of Saddam Hussein, it would have been a just war. And since what we're involved in now, all of us, is a sort of post-mortem or inquest about Iraq policy and its successes and failures, it seems that Scott Ritter, I'm pleased to see, agrees with me, that this inquest should not begin with George Bush's decision in 2003, but should at least begin with the argument which took place within the administration in 1991 as to whether it was correct to leave Saddam Hussein in power and to impose a cruel and ruinous regime of sanctions on Iraqi society and people. And I think that history vindicates those who said it would have been better to take him out then. By the way, I think the inquest could go further back, probably to the absolutely calamitous decision taken by Jimmy Carter to endorse Saddam Hussein's attack on Iran in 1979, which led to untold death and destruction and the rise of sectarianism and terrorism in the region. But those in the anti-war so-called movement who think that everything begins with trying to catch George Bush out in some warmongering are simply taking an ahistorical attitude to what is a very long-standing American commitment. We have obligations to Iraq. Iraq became a ward of American policy, and so did its people quite some time ago. We have to discharge that obligation fairly, and I believe a good start has been made by removing the Saddam Hussein regime and trying to create a federal and democratic system in these unpromising circumstances.
So that was your argument from the start? We had weapons of mass destruction and other arguments given, but have your arguments for going to war in Iraq remained consistent?
Well, since I adopted them, I think I could say that they had. I mean, I was by 2002, 2003, one of those quite small group of people in Washington who was arguing that the president should make this decision. We would have criticized him, in fact, if he had not removed Saddam from power. And though there were other reasons to do this, including some that extended into flouted United Nations resolutions concerning disarmament and disclosure on the part of Iraq, and also the very suggestive connections between Iraq and Islamic terrorism in the region. I believe the argument is much more deeply rooted than that. It's a responsibility we have inherited from several administrations to not leave Iraq worse than we found it, and that had to mean stopping compromising with Saddam, opening Iraqi society to democracy, and trying to suggest to people, to put it no higher, that a federal solution to their own internal problems is probably the only workable one. And I think the progress on that has been quite impressive. Incidentally, it's an uncovenanted benefit in a way, but it can't be disputed, I don't think. We can now certify Iraq as disarmed, which we could not have done before under any regime of inspection, because there was no possibility that one could take Saddam Hussein's word for this, regime for it. Mm-hmm. We now can say, which we could not before, that it is not a WMD state. We've also compelled the Libyans and some elements of the Pakistanis to follow suit on this. So as a non-proliferation policy, it's had some quite startling success also, even despite some, what shall we say, rather iffy stuff from the intelligence community.
Scott, the subtitle of your book is The Untold Story of the Intelligence Conspiracy to Undermine the UN and Overthrow Saddam Hussein. Is your main concern the fact that the United States did it on its own with the help of Britain and a few other allies, rather than went after Saddam through the UN?
My main concern is that the United States violated international law, and therefore, in doing so, violated the own precepts set forth in the Constitution, which I'm sworn to uphold and defend. Article 6, which of course says that when we enter into international treaties or agreements have been ratified by 2/3 of the United States Senate, that becomes the law of the land. We are signatories to a United Nations Charter, and therefore we are held accountable to that rule of law. The rule of law is paramount here, due process. I'm not against regime change. Again, in the book we quoted earlier, Endgame, I spell out that, you know, Saddam Hussein's regime, a case can and should be made for its removal from power. I felt that if we're going to accuse a man of committing crimes against humanity, that the least we should do is honor those who have suffered at the hands of Saddam by indicting Saddam Hussein through a process, due process, in accordance with the rule of law, and then holding him accountable for that indictment. That is not what we did. Instead, we cooked up a war based upon, and I don't accept the notion of bad intelligence, having been a firsthand participant in this operation from 1991 to 1998, I can tell you that the intelligence information, legitimate intelligence, that went through the processes of analysis that's indicative of, you know, a true intelligence data, showed that Iraq was qualitatively disarmed, that while we could not account for every nut, bolt, and screw relevant to a WMD program, by and large, the programs had been accounted for. A 95 to 97% level of verifiable accountability, and that we could mitigate against the unaccounted for materials by noting that the most intrusive technologically advanced arms control regime in the history of arms control had been imposed on the Iraqis. And yet the case made for war with Iraq was that Iraq was non-compliant, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and there was no data to back this up and reinforce this. It's one thing to say that we don't want to trust Saddam Hussein. I can tell you, as a weapons inspector who has firsthand experience with the lies of the Iraqi government, that we never trusted Saddam Hussein. But it's another thing altogether to reject the legitimate findings of the inspectors and to allow the inspection process to be politicized along with the intelligence, so that we come up with this completely false, misleading, fabricated justification for war which was weapons of mass destruction.
We will take a little break and we'll come back with Scott Ritter, whose latest book is Iraq Confidential, the untold story of the intelligence conspiracy to undermine the UN and overthrow Saddam Hussein. It's published by Nation Books. And Christopher Hitchens, whose latest book is Thomas Jefferson, author of America, published by Imminent Lives, obviously has nothing to do with the subject at hand, but Christopher Hitchens has written an awful lot about his support of the war in Iraq, and we will continue this conversation right after this break. And we're back with Christopher Hitchens and with Scott Ritter talking about the war in Iraq and their disagreements. Scott, a majority in Congress has called for an exit strategy. Many Americans are also speaking out against the war. Do you think that they'd be more gung-ho if things had gone better after Saddam was toppled?
There's no doubt in my mind that when one speaks of Congress and the American public, we need to recognize that neither group possesses an in-depth knowledge and understanding of Iraq. It's rather superficial at best. And what this means is that, of course, if things had gone well, if the war had gone well, I don't think there'd be any introspective rethink about weapons of mass destruction, the fact that we went to war saying that they were there, they turned out not to be there. I think had everything gone, very well, roses, et cetera, that there wouldn't be an issue today. There would be no anti-war movement. This is one of the great weaknesses of the so-called anti-war movement or of these Democrats who today speak out, I believe, only because the president's poll ratings are low. They don't have a fundamental belief system in place. They say they're anti-war, but they aren't anti-war. They're politically, they're motivated by political opportunism. It's sad that it takes 2,156 plus dead Americans, 15,000 wounded Americans, tens of thousands of dead Iraqis, and nearly a half a trillion dollars of U.S. taxpayer money, to need to be squandered before people say, "Hey, why are we at war today? Why is this taking place?" These are questions that needed to be asked before we went to war, before we incurred these costs. And tragically, for a variety of reasons, key of which, of course, is the events of September 11th and the dumbing down of America after that event, where their ignorance of the world we live in allowed their fears that grow from that ignorance to be exploited politically. We didn't have that debate. Now they're having it, but they're not having it armed with all the facts. They talk about an exit strategy, but an exit strategy from what? They don't have a strategy. All they have is political opportunism designed to score domestic political points against the Bush administration, which, because of its flawed policies in Iraq and elsewhere, is floundering.
Now, Christopher, the opposition to the war in Britain and the rest of Europe was there from the start. In this country, it seems to have switched because it didn't turn out as well as everyone would have hoped for. Do you think that this has just made the situation even worse in your home country?
No. I mean, I have nothing but contempt for the leadership of the anti-war movement for the most part. For one thing, most of its leaders are not anti-war at all. They are people like Ramsay Clark, for example, in this country, who take the other side in this war. They're not pacifists. They support the Ba'ath Party and did when it was in power and are engaged in supporting its violent and fascistic remnants to this day, or in my home country, but country of birth, I should say, George Galloway, who I recently debated, a renegade member of parliament, who is an open supporter of Ba'athism and of Al-Qaeda. That this is not an anti-war position and doesn't deserve to be called so. And those who are genuinely skeptical about the war, I think, have the obligation to disown this kind of spokesperson. I repeat my point that, in reply to Mr. Ritter, that the old Pottery Barn slogan that sometimes been used about Iraq, if you break it, you own it, was true before 2003. Iraq was already broken. We did own it. It was going south. It was an imploding regime and a very broken-down society. There were successors bidding for the next stage within Iraq, grouped under the Fedayeen Saddam, a group which tells you already but what its identity is, an alliance between the Ba'athist hardliners and the imported jihadists. Probably would have been under the leadership of either Uday or Qusay Hussein, charming guys. I wasn't really ready to wait to see how they were going to turn out. Since the confrontation was inevitable, and I don't think anyone would deny that there was going to have to be another round with Saddam Hussein, I thought it was right that we should pick the timing of it instead of, as in the past, leaving that determination to him. He decides when to invade Iran. He decides when to use chemical weapons and nerve gas and poison on the people of Kurdistan. He decides when to annex and abolish a member state of the United Nations, a rather graver violation of the UN Charter, I think, than any of the Bush administration's been responsible for. I thought we should say, no, we're taking the initiative away from you. You're through. Iraq is going to move into the post-Saddam era. That's important. And millions of people would have died just of famine and neglect and disease, by the way, in this process, as were already being killed by the sanctions. So on the casualty point, grim as it is, I think one can make a very strong humanitarian case for doing what was done. I'll just add one more thing. Iraq would certainly also have been invaded, but it would have been invaded by Turkey and Iran and by Saudi Arabia, each supporting their own tribal and sectarian proxies, if the coalition had not seized this initiative. So I have no qualms on any of these points at all, but I am thoroughly sick of hearing described as anti-war people who are open supporters of fascism in Afghanistan and Syria and Iraq and North Korea and Rwanda and former Yugoslavia, and make no bones about it. This is not an anti-war position. It's a very aggressive resort to the politics of violence, and it's used to deceive and exploit people whose main concern is, for example, the awful loss of life among Iraqis, Americans, and British.
My guests are Christopher Hitchens and also Scott Ritter, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Scott, President Bush has called Iraq a central front in the war on terror. Is that the way you see it?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, I'm not going to argue that under Saddam Hussein, you had a case could be made for what you could call a failed regime, that Iraq was a failed state. There's a number of reasons for that, not just the tyranny of the Ba'athists. I would also say the fact that Iraq had been subjected to a decade's worth of crippling economic sanctions also played no small part in the failure of that state to function on what we call normal lines. But what we do know about Saddam Hussein's Iraq is that when it comes to the events of September 11th, and we need to focus on that because this isn't about Saddam Hussein's linkage with the Palestinian Liberation Organization or his linkage with any Palestinian group, etc. September 11th, which is constantly invoked by the President of the United States, September 11th, 2001, the attack by Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda on the United States of America. That's the kind of terrorism that we're talking about. Al-Qaeda, Wahhabism, the Sunni-based fundamentalism, there was no linkage whatsoever between Saddam Hussein's government, as bad and tyrannical as it is, or was, and those who perpetrated these attacks. So for the president to speak of Iraq being a central front in that war on terror, he is absolutely incorrect. There was no linkage. Now, Iraq is a nation today that is awash in a sea of terror. Terror coming from Islamic fundamentalists, terror coming from former Ba'athists, terror coming from illegal occupationists. Yes, there's a whole host of terror-induced acts of violence occurring in Iraq on a daily basis. And if the president wants to say that this is now the central front of the war on terror, so be it, but he must disassociate his definition of terror from the events of September 11th and focus on a much broader definition that brings into account all perpetrators of terror, whether it be a suicide bomber in a marketplace or somebody dropping a bomb from 30,000 feet that lands in the middle of a wedding party.
I hate to break in, but we have very little time. I want to give Christopher a chance to give his opinion and find out from both of you very quickly, because we have a little over a minute, whether you think anybody's minds are going to be changed. Christopher, do you see it as the front on the war on terror?
Absolutely, I do, and I better be quick, and I must first register strong distaste for Mr. Ritter's equivalence between coalition troops and people who are beheaders and suicide bombers and torturers and maimers. and video killers. I just think that's a disgraceful amalgam. The man who blew up the World Trade Center, mixed the explosives for it in 1993, Mr. Yassin, an Iraqi, as were several of his comrades, went straight from New York to Iraq and were given protection. Mr. Yassin is being hunted in Iraq to this day by Saddam Hussein. It would be a very rash administration that decided not to take such a connection seriously. The Saddam regime praised the attacks of September 11th, devoted the whole of its propaganda to pumping out jihad, to welcoming foreign jihadists into Iraq, including Mr. Zarqawi, who was not there as a result of American or British presence, but was there beforehand, having come from Afghanistan. He's gone to all the trouble to seek and to receive permission from al-Qaeda to call his group al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, a name it absolutely deserves.
And we have to leave it
there. Iraq, in other words, was for the next one, not the previous one.
Thank you both so much, Christopher Hitchens and Scott Ritter. It's I hate to say this, it's been a lot of fun.
Aren't you going to mention our debate?